They glissaded down the steep face of the dune on their boot heels. At the bottom, Nadia gave Anne an impulsive hug. "Oh, Anne, I don't know how to thank you for that." Even through the tinted faceplates, she could see Anne grin. A rare sight. After that, things looked different to Nadia. Oh, she knew it was in herself, that it was a matter of paying attention in a new way, of looking. But the landscape conspired in this sensation, feeding her new attentiveness, because the very next day they left the black dunes and drove on to what her companions called layered or laminate terrain. This was the region of flat sand that in winter would lie under the CO2 skirt of the polar cap. Now in midsummer it lay revealed, a landscape made entirely of curvilinear patterns. They drove up broad flat washes of yellow sand that were bounded by long sinuous flat-topped plateaus. The sides of the plateaus were stepped and benched, laminated both finely and grossly, looking like wood that had been cut and polished to show a handsome grain. None of them had ever seen any land remotely like it, and they spent the mornings taking samples and borings and hiking around in a loping Martian ballet, talking a blue streak, Nadia as excited as any of them. Anne explained to her that each winter's frost caught a lamina on the surface. Then wind erosion had cut arroyos and stripped away at their sides, and each stratum was stripped back farther than the one below it, so that the arroyo walls consisted of hundreds of narrow terraces. "It's like the land is a contour map of itself," Simon said. They drove during the days and went out every evening in purply dusks that lasted until just before midnight. They drilled borings and came up with cores that were gritty and icy, laminated for as far down as they could drill. One evening, Nadia was climbing with Anne up a series of parallel terraces, half listening to her explain about the procession of aphelion and perihelion, when she looked back across the arroyo and saw that it was glowing like lemons and apricots in the evening light, and that above the arroyo were pale green lenticular clouds, mimicking perfectly the terrain's French curves. "Look!" she exclaimed. Anne looked back and saw it, and was still. They watched the low banded clouds float overhead. Finally, a dinner call from the rovers brought them back. And walking down over the contoured terraces of sand, Nadia knew that she had changed. That, or else the planet was getting much more strange and beautiful as they traveled north. Or both. They rolled over flat terraces of yellow sand, sand so fine and hard and clear of rocks that they could go at full speed, slowing down only to shift up or down from one bench to another. Occasionally, the rounded slope between terraces gave them some trouble, and once or twice they even had to backtrack to find a way. But usually a route north could be found without difficulty. On their fourth day in the laminate terrain, the plateau walls flanking their flat wash curved together, and they drove up the cleavage onto a higher plain. And there before them on the new horizon was a white hill, a great rounded thing like a white Ayers rock. A white hill. It was ice. A hill of ice, 100 meters high and 1 kilometer wide, and when they drove around it, they saw that it continued over the horizon to the north. It was the tip of a glacier, perhaps a tongue of the polar cap itself. In the other cars they were shouting, and in the noise and confusion, Nadia could only hear Phyllis crying, "Water! Water!" Water, indeed. Though they had known it was going to be there, it was still startling in the extreme to run into a whole great white hill of it, in fact the tallest hill they had seen in the entire 5,000 kilometers of their voyage. It took them all that first day to get used to it. They stopped the rovers, pointed, chattered, got out to have a look, took surface samples and borings, touched it, climbed up it a ways. Like the sand around it, the ice hill was horizontally laminated, with lines of dust about 1 centimeter apart. Between the lines, the ice was pocked and granular. In this atmospheric pressure, it sublimed at almost all temperatures, leaving pitted, rotten sidewalls to a depth of a few centimeters. Under that, it was solid and hard. "This is a lot of water," they all said at one point or another. Water on the surface of Mars. The next day, the Glacier Hill formed their right horizon, a wall that ran on beside them for the whole day's drive. Then it really began to seem like a lot of water, especially as over the course of the day the wall got taller, rising to a height of about 300 meters, a kind of white mountain ridge, in fact, walling off their flat-bottomed valley on its east side. And then, over the horizon to the northwest, there appeared another white hill, the top of another ridge poking over the horizon, the base remaining beneath it. Another Glacier Hill, walling them into the west some 30 kilometers away. So they were in Chasma Borealis, a wind-carved valley that cut north into the ice cap for some 500 kilometers, more than half the distance to the pole. The chasm's floor was flat sand, hard as concrete, and often crunchy with a layer of CO2 frost. The chasm's ice walls were tall, but not vertical. They lay back at an angle less than 45 degrees, and like the hillsides in the laminate terrain, they were terraced, the terraces ragged with wind erosion and sublimation, the two forces that over tens of thousands of years had cut the whole length of the chasm. Rather than driving up to the head of the valley, the explorers crossed to the western wall, aiming toward a transponder that had been included in a drop of ice mining equipment. The sand dunes mid-chasm were low and regular, and the rovers rolled over the corrugated land up and down, up and down. Then as they crested a sand wave, they spotted the drop, no more than 2 kilometers from the foot of the northwest ice wall. Bulky lime-green containers on skeletal landing modules, a strange sight in this world of whites and tans and pinks. "What an eyesore!" Anne exclaimed, but Phyllis and George were cheering. During the long afternoon, the shadowed western ice side took on a variety of pale colors. The purest water ice was clear and bluish, but most of the hillside was a translucent ivory, copiously tinted by pink and yellow dust. Irregular patches of CO2 ice were a bright, pure white. The contrast between dry ice and water ice was vivid, and made it impossible to read the actual contours of the hillside. And foreshortening made it hard to tell how tall the hill really was. It seemed to go up forever, and was probably somewhere between 300 and 500 meters above the floor of Borealis. "This is a lot of water," Nadia exclaimed. "And there's more underground," Phyllis said. "Our borings show that the cap actually extends many degrees of latitude farther south than we see, buried under the layered terrain." "So we have more water than we'll ever need." Anne pursed her mouth unhappily. The drop of the mining equipment had determined the site of the ice mining camp. The west wall of Chasma Borealis at longitude 41, latitude 83 north. Deimos had just recently followed Phobos under the horizon. They wouldn't see it again until they returned south of 82 north. The summer nights consisted of an hour's purple twilight. The rest of the time the sun wheeled around, never more than 20 degrees above the horizon. The six of them spent long hours outside, moving the ice miner to the wall and then setting it up. The main component was a robotic tunnel borer, about the size of one of their rovers. The borer cut into the ice and passed back cylindrical drums 1.5 meters in diameter. When they turned the borer on, it made a loud, low buzz, which was louder still if they put their helmets to the ice or even touched it with their hands. After a while, white ice drums thumped into a hopper, and then a small robot forklift carried them to a distillery, which would melt the ice and separate out its considerable load of dust, then refreeze the water into 1-meter cubes more suitable for packing in the holds of the rovers. Robot freight rovers would then be perfectly capable of driving to the site, loading up, and returning to base on their own. And base would then have a regular water supply, larger than they could ever use. Around 4 or 5 million cubic kilometers in the visible polar cap, Edvard calculated, though there were a lot of guesses in the calculation. They spent several days testing the miner and deploying an array of solar panels to power it. In the long evenings after dinner, Anne would climb the ice wall, ostensibly to take more borings, although Nadia knew she just wanted away from Phyllis and Edvard and George. And naturally she wanted to climb all the way to the top to get on the polar cap and look around and take borings of the most recent layers of ice. So one day when the miner had passed all the test routines, she and Nadia and Simon got up at dawn, just after 2 a.m., and went out into the super-cold morning air and climbed, their shadows like big spiders climbing before them. The slope of the ice was about 30 degrees, steepening and then letting off time after time as they ascended the rough benches in the hill's layered side. It was 7 a.m. when the slope lay back and they walked onto the surface of the polar cap. To the north was a plain of ice that extended as far as they could see, to a high horizon some 30 kilometers away. Looking back to the south, they could see a great distance over the geometric swirls of the layered terrain. It was the longest view Nadia had ever had on Mars. The ice of the plateau was layered much like the laminated sand below them, with wide bands of dirty pink contouring across cleaner stuff. The other wall of Chasma Borealis lay off to the east, looking almost vertical from their point of view, long, tall, massive. "So much water," Nadia said again. "It's more than we'll ever need." "That depends," Anne said absently, screwing the frame of the little borer into the ice. Her darkened faceplate turned up at Nadia. "If the terraformers have their way, this will all go like dew on a hot morning, into the air to make pretty clouds." "Would that be so bad?" Nadia asked. Anne stared at her. Through the tinted faceplate, her eyes looked like ball bearings. That night at dinner, she said, "We really ought to make a run up to the pole." Phyllis shook her head. "We don't have the food or air." "Call for a drop." Edvard shook his head. "The polar cap is cut by valleys almost as deep as Borealis." "Not so," Anne said. "You could drive straight to it. The swirl valleys look dramatic from space, but that's because of the difference in albedo between the water and the CO2. The actual slopes are never more than 6 degrees off the horizontal. It's just more layered terrain, really." George said, "But what about getting onto the cap in the first place?" "We drive around to one of the tongues of ice that drop to the sand. They're like ramps up to the central massif, and once there, we drive right to the pole." "There's no reason to go," Phyllis said. "It'll just be more of what we see here, and it means more exposure to radiation." "And," George added, "we could use what food and air we do have to check out some of the sites we passed on the way up here." So that was their point. Anne scowled. "I'm the head of the Geological Survey," she said sharply. Which may have been true, but she was a horrible politician, especially compared to Phyllis, who had any number of friends in Houston and Washington. "But there's no geological reason to go to the pole," Phyllis said now with a smile. "It'll be the same ice as here. You just want to go." "Well," Anne said, "say I do. There are still scientific questions to be answered up there. Is the ice the same composition? How much dust? Everywhere we go up here, we collect valuable data." "But we're up here to get water. We're not up here to fool around." "It's not fooling around," Anne snapped. "We obtain water to allow us to explore. We don't explore just to obtain water. You've got it backwards. I can't believe how many people in this colony do that." Nadia said, "Let's see what they say at base. They might want us to help with something there, or they might not be able to send a drop, you never know." Anne groaned. "We'll end up asking permission from the UN, I swear." She was right. Frank and Maya didn't like the idea. John was interested, but noncommittal. Arcadi supported it when he heard of it, and declared he would send a supply drop from Phobos if necessary, which, given its orbit, was impractical at best. But at that point, Maya called Mission Control in Houston and Baikonur, and the argument rippled outward. Hastings opposed the plan, but Baikonur and a lot of the scientific community liked it. Finally, Anne got on the phone, her voice very curt and arrogant, though she looked scared. "I'm the geological head here, and I say it needs to be done. There won't be any better opportunity to get on-site data on the original condition of the polar cap. It's a delicate system, and any change in the atmosphere is going to impact it heavily. And you've got plans to do that, right? Sachs, are you still working on those windmill heaters?" Sachs hadn't been a part of the discussion, and he had to be called to the phone. "Sure," he said when the question was repeated. He and Hiroko had come up with the idea of manufacturing small windmills to be dropped from dirigibles all over the planet. The constant westerlies would spin the windmills, and the spin would be converted to heat in coils in the base of the mills, and this heat would simply be released into the atmosphere. Sachs had already designed a robotic factory to manufacture the windmills. He hoped to make them by the thousands. Vlad pointed out that the heat gained would come at the price of winds slowed down. You couldn't get something for nothing. Sachs immediately argued that that would be a side benefit, given the severity of the global dust storms the wind sometimes caused. A little heat for a little wind is a great trade-off. "So, a million windmills," Anne said now. "And that's just the start. You talked about spreading black dust on the polar caps, didn't you, Sachs? It would thicken the atmosphere faster than practically any other action we could take." "So if you get your way," Anne said, "the caps are doomed. They'll evaporate, and then we're going to say, 'I wonder what they were like,' and we won't know." "Do you have enough supplies, enough time?" John asked. "We'll drop you supplies," Arkady said again. "There's 4 more months of summer," Anne said. "You just want to go to the pole," Frank said, echoing Phyllis. "So," Anne replied, "you may have come here to play office politics, but I plan to see a bit of this place." Nadia grimaced. That ended that line of conversation, and Frank would be angry, which was never a good idea. Anne. The next day, the Terran offices weighed in with the opinion that the polar cap ought to be sampled in its aboriginal condition. No objections from base, though Frank did not get back on the line. Simon and Nadia cheered. "North to the pole!" Phyllis just shook her head. "I don't see the point. George and Edvard and I will stay down here as a backup and make sure the ice miner is working right." So Anne and Nadia and Simon took Rover 3 and drove back down Chasma Borealis and around to the west, where one of the glaciers curling away from the cap thinned to a perfect rampway. The mesh of the rover's big wheels caught like a snowmobile's drivetrain, running well over all the various surfaces of the cap, over patches of exposed granular dust, low hills of hard ice, fields of blinding white CO2 frost, and the usual lace of sublimed water ice. Shallow valleys swirled outward in a clockwise pattern from the pole. Some of these were very broad. Crossing these, they would drive down a bumpy slope that curved away to right and left over both horizons, all of it covered by bright, dry ice. This could last for 20 kilometers, until the whole visible world was bright white. Then before them, a rising slope of the more familiar dirty red water ice would appear, striated by contour lines. As they crossed the bottom of the trough, the world would be divided in two, white behind, dirty pink ahead. Driving up the south-facing slopes, they found the water ice more rotten than elsewhere. But as Anne pointed out, every winter a meter of dry ice sat on the permanent cap to crush the previous summer's rotten filigree, so the potholes were filled on an annual schedule, and the rover's big wheels crunched cleanly along. Beyond the swirl valleys, they found themselves on a smooth white plain, extending to the horizon in every direction. Behind the polarized and tinted glass of the rover's windows, the whiteness was unmarred and pure. Once they passed a low ring hill, the mark of some relatively recent meteor impact filled in by subsequent ice deposition, they stopped to take borings, of course. Nadia had to restrict Anne and Simon to 4 borings a day to save time and keep the rover's trunks from being overloaded. And it wasn't just borings. Often they would pass black, isolated rocks resting on the ice like Magritte sculptures, meteorites. They collected the smallest of these and took samples from the larger ones, and once passed one that was as big as the rover. They were nickel iron, for the most part, or stony chondrites. Chipping away at one of these, Anne said to Nadia, "You know, they found meteorites on Earth that came from Mars. The reverse happens, too, although much less often. It takes a really big impact to jack rocks out of Earth's gravitational field fast enough to get them out here, delta V of 15 kilometers per second at least. I've heard it said that about 2% of the material ejected out of Earth's field would end up on Mars, but only from the biggest impacts, like the KT boundary impact. It would be strange to find a chunk of the Yucatan here, wouldn't it?" "But that was 60 million years ago," Nadia said. "It would be buried under the ice." "True." Later, walking back to the rover, she said, "Well, if they melt these caps, then we'll find some. We'll have a whole museum of meteorites sitting around on the sand." They crossed more swirl valleys, falling again into the up-and-down pattern of a boat over waves, this time the largest waves yet, 40 kilometers from crest to crest. They used the clocks to keep on a schedule and parked from 10 p.m. to 5 a.m. on hillocks or buried crater rims to give themselves a view during their stops, and they blacked the windows with double polarization to help them to get some sleep at night. Then one morning as they crunched along, Anne turned on the radio and began to run checks with the aerosynchronous satellites. "It's not easy to find the pole," she said as she worked. "The early Terran explorers had a hell of a time in the north. They were always up there in summertime and couldn't see the stars, and they had no satellite checks." "So how did they do it?" Nadia asked, suddenly curious. Anne thought about it and smiled. "I don't know. Not very well, I suspect. Probably dead reckoning." Nadia became intrigued by the problem and started working on it on a sketch pad. Geometry had never been her strong point. But presumably at the North Pole on Midsummer's Day, the sun would inscribe a perfect circle around the horizon, never getting higher or lower. If you were near the pole then, and it was near Midsummer's Day, you might be able to use a sextant to make timed checks on the sun's height above the horizon. Was that right? "This is it," Anne said. "What?" They stopped the rover, looked around. The white plain undulated to the nearby horizon, featureless except for a couple of broad red contour lines. The lines didn't form bullseye circles around them, and it didn't look like they were at the top of anything. "Where, exactly?" Nadia asked. "Well, somewhere just north of here," Anne smiled again. "Within a kilometer or so, maybe that way," she pointed off to the right. "We'll have to go over there a ways and check with the satellite again. A little bit of triangulation, and we should be able to hit it on the nose. Plus or minus 100 meters, anyway."
"If we just took the time, we could make it plus or minus a meter," Simon said enthusiastically. "Let's pin it down."
So they drove for a minute, consulted the radio, turned to right angles, and drove again, made another consultation. Finally, Anne declared they were there, or close enough. Simon instructed the computer to keep working on it, and they suited up and went out and wandered around a bit to make sure they had stepped on it. Anne and Simon drilled the boring. Nadia kept walking in a spiral that expanded away from the car. A reddish-white plain, the horizon some 4 kilometers away. Too close. It came to her in a rush, as during the Black Dune sunset, that this was alien, a sharp awareness of the tight horizon, the dreamy gravity, a world just so big and no bigger. And now she was standing right on its north pole.
It was LS-92, about as near midsummer as you could ask, so if she stood facing the sun and didn't move, the sun would stay level and circle around her for all the rest of the day, or the rest of the week, for that matter. It was strange. She was spinning like a top. If she stood still long enough, would she feel it? Her polarized faceplate reduced the sun's glare on the ice to an arc of crystalline rainbow points. It wasn't very cold. She could just feel a breeze against her upraised palm. A graceful red streak of depositional laminae ran over the horizon like a longitude line. She laughed at the thought. There was a very faint ice ring around the sun, big enough that its lower arc just touched the horizon. Ice was subliming off the polar cap and gleaming in the air above, providing the crystals in the ring. Grinning, she stomped her boot prints into the North Pole of Mars. That evening, they aligned the polarizers so that a very dimmed-down image of the white desert stood around them in the module windows. Nadia sat back with an empty food tray in her lap, sipping a cup of coffee. The digital clock flicked from 11:59:59 to zero and stopped. Its stillness accentuated the quietness in the car. Simon was asleep. Anne sat in the driver's seat, staring out at the scene, her dinner half-eaten. No sound but the whoosh of the ventilator. "I'm glad you got us up here," Nadia said. "It's been great." "Someone should enjoy it," Anne said. When she was angry or bitter, her voice became flat and distant, almost as if she were being matter-of-fact. "It won't be here long." "Are you sure, Anne? It's 5 kilometers deep here, isn't that what you said? Do you really think it will completely disappear just because of black dust on it?" Anne shrugged. "It's a question of how warm we make it, and of how much total water there is on the planet, and how much of the water in the regolith will surface when we heat the atmosphere. We won't know any of those things until they happen. But I suspect that since this cap is the primary exposed body of water, it'll be the most sensitive to change. It could sublime away almost entirely before any significant part of the permafrost has gotten within 50 degrees of melting." "Entirely? Oh, some will be deposited every winter, sure. But there's not that much water when you put it in the global perspective. This is a dry world. The atmosphere is super arid. It makes Antarctica look like a jungle. And remember how that place used to suck us dry? So if temperatures go up high enough, the ice will sublime at a really rapid rate. This whole cap will shift into the atmosphere and blow south, where it'll frost out at nights. So in effect, it'll be redistributed more or less evenly over the whole planet as frost about a centimeter thick." She grimaced. "Less than that, of course, because most of it will stay in the air. But then if it gets hotter still, the frost will melt and it will rain. Then we've got rivers and lakes, right? If the atmospheric pressure is high enough, liquid surface water depends on air pressure as well as temperature. If both rise, we could be walking around on sand here in a matter of decades."
"It'd be quite a meteorite collection," Nadia said, trying to lighten Anne's mood. It didn't work. Anne pursed her lips, stared out the window, shook her head. Her face could be so bleak. It couldn't be explained entirely by Mars. There had to be something more to it, something that explained that intense internal spin, that anger. Bessie Smith land. It was hard to watch. When Maya was unhappy, it was like Ella Fitzgerald singing a blues. You knew it was a put-on. The exuberance just poured through it. But when Anne was unhappy, it hurt to watch it. Now she picked up her dish of lasagna, leaned back to stick it in the microwave. Beyond her, the white waste gleamed under a black sky, as if the world outside were a photo negative. The clock face suddenly read 1 second past midnight. 4 days later, they were off the ice. As they retraced their route back to Phyllis and George and Edvard, the three travelers rolled over a rise and came to a halt. There was a structure on the horizon. Out on the flat sediment of the chasma floor there stood a classical Greek temple, six Dorian columns of white marble capped by a round, flat roof.
What the hell?
When they got closer, they saw that the columns were made of ice drums from the miner, stacked on top of each other. The disc that served as roof was rough-hewn.
George's idea, Phyllis said over the radio. I noticed the ice cylinders were the same size as the marble drums the Greeks used for their pillars, George said, still pleased with himself. After that, it was obvious, and the miner is running perfectly, so he had some time to kill.
It looks great, Simon said, and it did. Alien monument, dream visitation. It glowed like flesh in the long dusk, as if blood ran under its ice.
A temple to Ares.
To Neptune, corrected George.
We don't want to invoke Ares too often, I don't think.
Especially given the crowd at base camp, Anne said. As they drove south, their road of tracks and transponders ran ahead of them, as distinct as any highway of paved concrete. It didn't take Anne to point out how much this changed the feel of their travel. They were no longer exploring untouched land, and the nature of the landscape itself was altered, split left and right by the parallel lines of cross-hatched wheel tracks, and by the green canisters slightly dimmed by a rime of dust, all marking the way. It wasn't wilderness anymore. That was the point of road building, after all. They could leave the driving to Rover 3 automatic pilot, and often did. So they were trundling along at 30 kilometers per hour with nothing to do but look at the bisected view or talk, which they did infrequently, except on the morning they got into a heated discussion about Frank Chalmers, Anne maintaining that he was a complete Machiavellian, Phyllis insisting that he was no worse than anyone else in power, and Nadia, remembering her talks with him about Maya, knowing it was more complex than either of those views. But it was Anne's lack of discretion that appalled her, and as Phyllis went on about how Frank had held them together in the last months of the voyage out, Nadia glared at Anne, trying to convey to her by looks that she was talking in the wrong crowd. Phyllis would use her indiscretions against her later on, that was obvious, but Anne was bad at seeing looks. Then suddenly the rover braked and slowed to a stop. No one had been watching, and they all jumped to the front window. There before them was a flat white sheet covering their road for nearly 100 meters.
What is it? George cried.
Our permafrost pump, Nadia said, pointing. It must have broken.
Or worked too well, Simon said. That's water ice.
They switched the rover to manual, drove nearer. The spill covered the road like a wash of white lava. They struggled into their walkers and got out of the module, walked over to the edge of the spill.
Our own ice rink, Nadia said, and went to the pump.
She unhooked the insulation pad and had a look inside.
Aha! A gap in the insulation. Water froze right here, and jammed the stopcock in the open position. A good head of pressure, I'd say. Ran till it froze thick enough to stop it. A tap from a hammer might get us our own little geyser.
She went to her tool cabinet in the underside of the module, took out a pick.
Watch out!
She struck a single blow at the white mass of ice where the pump joined the tank feeder pipe. A thick bolt of water squirted a meter into the air.
Wow!
It splashed down onto the white sheet of ice, steaming even though it froze within seconds, making a white, lobate leaf on top of the ice already there.
Look at that!
The hole, too, froze over, and the stream of water stopped, and the steam blew away.
Look how fast it froze!
Looks just like those splosh craters, Nadia remarked, grinning. It had been a beautiful sight, water spilling out and steaming like mad as it froze. Nadia chipped away at the ice around the stop valve, while Anne and Phyllis argued about migration of permafrost and quantities of water at this latitude, etc., etc. One would think they'd get sick of it, but they really did dislike each other, and so they were helpless to stop. It would be the last trip they ever took together, no doubt about it. Nadia herself would be disinclined to travel with Phyllis and George and Edvard anymore. They were too complacent, too much a little in-group of their own. But Anne was alienated from quite a few other people as well. If she didn't watch out, she'd be without anyone at all to accompany her on trips. Frank, for instance, that comment to him the other night, and then telling Phyllis, of all people, how horrible he was. Incredible. And if she alienated everyone but Simon, she would be hurting for conversation, for Simon Fraser was the quietest man in the whole hundred. He had hardly said 20 sentences the entire length of the trip. It was uncanny, like traveling with a deaf mute. Except maybe he talked to Anne when they were alone. Who knew? Nadia worked the valve into its stop position, then shut the whole pump down. "We'll have to use thicker insulation this far north," she said to no one in particular as she took her tools back to the rover. She was tired of all the sniping, anxious to get back to base camp and her work. She wanted to talk with Arkady. He would make her laugh, and without trying or even knowing exactly how, she would make him laugh too. They put a few chunks of the ice spill in among the rest of the samples and set out 4 transponders to guide robot pilots around the spill. "Although it may sublime away, right?" Nadia said. Anne, lost in thought, didn't hear the question. "There's a lot of water up here," she muttered to herself, sounding worried. "You're damned right there is," Phyllis exclaimed. "Now why don't we have a look at those deposits we've spotted at the north end of Mariottis?" As they got closer to base, Anne became more close-mouthed and solitary, her face held tight as a mask. "What's the matter?" Nadia asked one evening when they were out together near sunset, fixing a defective transponder. "I don't want to go back," Anne said. She was kneeling by an isolated rock, chipping at it. "I don't want this trip to end. I'd like to keep traveling all the time, down into the canyons, up to the volcano rims, into the chaos and the mountains around Hellas. I don't ever want to stop." She sighed. "But I'm part of the team, so I have to climb back into the hovel with everyone else." "Is it really that bad?" Nadia said, thinking of her beautiful barrel vaults, of the steaming whirlpool bath and a glass of icy vodka. "You know it is. 24.5 hours a day, underground in those little rooms, with Maya and Frank running their political schemes, and Arkady and Phyllis fighting over everything, which I understand now, believe me, and George complaining, and John floating in a fog, and Hiroko obsessed by her little empire. Vlad, too. Sax, too. I mean, what a crowd. They're no worse than any other. No worse and no better. You have to get along. You couldn't be here all by yourself." "No. But it feels like I'm not here anyway when I'm at the base. Might as well be back on the ship." "No, no," Nadia said. "You're forgetting." She kicked the rock Anne was working on, and Anne looked up in surprise. "You can kick rocks, see? We're here, Anne. Here on Mars, standing on it, and every day you can go out and run around, and you'll be taking as many trips as anyone with your position." Anne looked away. "It doesn't seem like enough sometimes." Nadia stared at her. "Well, Anne, it's radiation keeping us underground more than anything. What you're saying, in effect, is that you want the radiation to go away, which means thickening the atmosphere, which means terraforming." "I know." Her voice was tight, so tight that suddenly the careful matter-of-fact tone was lost and forgotten. "Don't you think I know?" She stood and waved the hammer. "But it isn't right. I mean, I look at this land and I love it. I want to be out on it, traveling over it always, to study it and live on it and learn it. But when I do that, I change it. I destroy what it is, what I love in it. This road we made, it hurts me to see it. And base camp is like an open pit mine in the middle of a desert never touched since time began. So ugly, so... I don't want to do that to all of Mars, Nadia. I don't. I'd rather die.
Let the planet be, leave it wilderness, and let radiation do what it will. It's only a statistical matter anyway. I mean, if it raises my chance of cancer to 1 in 10, then 9 times out of 10 I'm all right.
Fine for you, Nadia said. Or for any individual. But for the group, for all the living things here, the genetic damage, you know? Over time it would cripple us. So, you know, you can't just think of yourself.
Part of a team, Anne said dully.
Well, you are.
I know, she sighed. We all say that. We'll all go on and make the place safe. Roads, cities, new sky, new soil, until it's all some kind of Siberia or Northwest Territories, and Mars will be gone and we'll be here. And we'll wonder why we feel so empty. Why, when we look at the land, we can never see anything but our own faces.
On the 62nd day of their expedition, they saw plumes of smoke over the southern horizon, strands of brown, gray, white, and black rising and mixing, billowing into a flat-topped mushroom cloud that wisped off to the east. "Home again, home again," Phyllis said cheerily. Their tracks from the trip out, half-filled by dust, led them back toward the smoke. Through the freight landing zone, across ground crisscrossed with treadmarks, across ground trampled to light red sand, past ditches and mounds, pits and piles, and finally to the great raw mound of the permanent habitat, a square earthen redoubt now topped by a silvery network of magnesium beams. That sight piqued Nadia's interest, but as they rolled on in, she couldn't help noticing the litter of frames, crates, tractors, cranes, spare part dumps, garbage dumps, windmills, solar panels, water towers, concrete roads leading east, west, and south, air miners, the low buildings of the alchemists' quarter, their smokestacks emitting the plumes they had seen. The stacks of glass, the round cones of gray gravel, the big mounds of raw regolith next to the cement factory, the small mounds of regolith scattered everywhere else. It had the disordered, functional, ugly look of Chelyabinsk 65, or any of the rest of the other Stalinist heavy industry cities in the Urals, or the oil camps of Yakutia.